From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Davia Nelson is my guest, a public radio pioneer. Davia Nelson is one half of the Kitchen Sisters, along with Nikki Silva. And their work can be heard on radio stations like KSQD and other places, and his podcast as well. And the Kitchen Sisters have won Peabody Awards. Their work is in the Library of Congress. They're educators and entertainers simultaneously. And Davia Nelson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Such a pleasure to be here with you, Gary.
I'm so excited. Davia and I have known each other for like 50 years, which is odd because we're both 28. So it's really a strange kind of time.
In our first life and in this life.
You and I met at a wonderful Jewish summer camp in Southern California, Camp JCA. Do you have good memories of Camp JCA?
I do have good memories. I was nature specialist, yes, of all things at the Jewish summer camp. I love camping, being in nature and getting to share that with campers and all the skills and the craziness and the eccentricities of the counselors in those camps, and the intelligence and the dancing and the music. It really stuck with me. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I sometimes have dreams that are set there. But I went there for a zillion years. But do you think being Jewish has influenced your work that you've done with the Kitchen Sisters?
I'm sure it has. I mean, I come from a storytelling tradition. I come from a tradition of civil rights and activism, which I think of, for me, because we were basically secular, I participate. JCA was the extent of my Judaism, basically. We weren't that kind of family.
Most of us, yeah.
Yeah, but I felt like culture, human rights, all those things were at the center for me. So yeah, music, deep
music,
connection to music and story.
Well, you and your sister, who's a film director, Jessie Nelson, who I met at camp also, are both in the entertainment industry. Was that a family business?
No, it wasn't. I mean, but I think my journalism was more what our parents were aspiring to and hoped to do. Though I think my dad, especially once both of us worked in movies and then Jessie going on to direct and write, you know, real features, it brought out the desire in him more and more to do that. You know, he couldn't wait to get to be an extra on the set in Karina Karina or I Am Sam, you know, just films that Jessie wrote and directed, you know, that kind of thing. When we've been sending our work to the Library of Congress, I have been going through all our old files, and I find this whole file of across 30 years where my father would write me, if we were doing Lost and Found Sound, the radio series on NPR about how sound shapes history, history shaped by sound, people possessed by sound, oral traditions. My father would constantly send me letters, notes, suggestions for stories. When we started the Hidden Kitchen series, same thing. He was always on the lookout and clipping. He was a constant clipper. Hidden World of Girls, The Keepers, about activists, archivists, rogue librarians. He was always at the ready to jump in and help tell the story. Yeah.
That's great. What did your parents do?
Well, my mother died when Jessie and I were little girls. She was in a car accident, but she had studied journalism and gone, actually, I live in San Francisco, and she had come here in 1945 as an intern with The Nation magazine to cover the opening of the United Nations. And then she met my father, who was a progressive World War II vet after World War II. And then they both set off as sort of journalists on their life's work. But things didn't quite work out in that way. And then my father worked in advertising and public relations for Prudential Life Insurance. He was a madman, exactly. And then our stepmother was a musician, came from a long line of classical musicians. She was a pianist and Her father was a violinist under Toscanini in the NBC Symphony, and wow. her brother was probably one of the greatest bassoonists that ever lived, Leonard Sherrow. Oh. And her first husband was a cellist and in classical orchestras and Roger Kellaway cello quartet. So there was music all around on that side.
Did you play an instrument? Do you play an instrument?
I don't now, but I was obsessed growing up with the auto harp and with guitar. And I thought that I was, there was, Joan Baez and I were like this in my
in your mind.
She was my spirit animal.
Well, she lives around the corner from you. You've probably met her now.
I, you know, I just met her this past Christmas and I had trouble not staying in my body, you know, not hovering. It was a moment where I walked into a room and Linda Ronstadt and Bonnie Raitt were alone in the room speaking. I sat down in the room and just, you know, was with them. And then ding dong, and the door opened and Joan Baez walked in. So I sat with those three women.
It's like Mount Rushmore of great.
Exactly. My high school, I went to high school with great musicians. The guys who became Toto were Grant, where I went and where Jesse went. So the Picaro brothers and all those guys, and Rural Still Life was the name of the band they were in high school. And we had the best high school band ever, you know. The dances were good.
It's really interesting. I mean, we were just talking about you and your sister, and to think back on the people you knew when you were kids, and all of a sudden, oh, look, they're making movies. They're doing great radio.
Yeah.
So I remember you on KUSP, which was our community supported station here in Santa Cruz, doing you did like a jazz show, or you played records, right?
Well, we called the first time I was on KUSP, it was with Mark Hand, and we did an old people's radio show that we called Every Wrinkle Tells a Story. And we were interviewing elders and we were kind of telling story, but the music we were playing was almost always jazz. Mm. And then Mark went on to be the Johnny Appleseed of public radio stations, helping found them and save them, and went into that tier of work. And then I met Nikki Silva, and she was working at the Natural History Museum in Santa Cruz. And Nikki was approaching a lot of the elders of the town, but from a museum perspective, their Indian basket collections or their paintings or, you know, different things that they were doing exhibits about. And people suggested that we meet, and we did. And we just clicked fast and became, you know, Nikki took to radio super quick, and we started doing. And then early on, we had a Tuesday afternoon slot on KUSP, and we were doing an interview with a guy who'd written the book, The Sidewalk Companion to Santa Cruz Architecture. And Nikki had just bought this commune, land that has become a commune. And we were making a dinner, cooking a salmon dinner there on a Saturday night and prepping for our Tuesday interview about this book. And it was the story of the Kitchen Brothers, those stonemasons who lived in Santa Cruz. And when we got on the show on Tuesday and interviewed John, who wrote the book, and said, tell us the story of the Kitchen Brothers, not to be confused with the Kitchen Sisters who are here with you today, because we start calling ourselves that in the kitchen as we burnt the salmon. And it was that era of political prisoners, the, you know, Soledad brothers and all that. And someone made a bumper sticker that said, free the Kitchen Sisters. And we just went from there. We both have strange names, Davia Nelson, Nikki Silva, and a lot of the older people we were interviewing were, well, not just older people. Many people were botching the names. And the Kitchen Sisters, you know, the kitchen, it's the room where the best stories are told and where the, you know, the room that smells the best. And just kind of, even though we didn't do food stories for another 25 years, but it was just at the essence of it.
But spoken word radio was your thing right from the beginning then?
Spoken word mixed with music. They're never far apart for either of us, you know, always loving. I mean, KUSP had a record collection I don't know where it went when the station went down. I hope they kept their vinyl intact. I hope someone has that because it was just remarkable. And we would spend hours and hours going through it and building sets of music. And then we would make mixtapes. This is, you know, in the early 80s, we were just in that little production studio making mixtapes onto cassettes and then building out our show. But then we would have guests and we would have, you know, activists and filmmakers. I mean, Les Blank was on our on the Kitchen Sisters, maybe second, third, fourth, fifth show we ever did. John Els, the great documentary filmmaker. We were always scanning the perimeter and the Road Ranger, who people in Santa Cruz probably remember.
Yeah.
He dressed up like the sort of riffing off the Lone Ranger and called himself the Scourge of the Towhook and the Long Delay, the Champion of the Stranded Traveler, the Bloodhound of Breakdown, and cruised in a Ford Ranchero on Highway 17, laden with 700 pounds of vehicle-saving devices. And Nikki met him at the KOA near where she lives. And he was one of the first, he was, the story we did with him was the first time we learned to cut tape. We did that in the KOSP studio and the first story we had on NPR. That's what led us to being on NPR.
Ah, well, I want to ask you about that. But so you, you still have all these things. Your, even your earliest broadcasts, have you saved them all?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's, I'm sure a couple have gone rogue, but 90, I'd say a good 90% of, I think our first piece went on NPR in 79 or 80, and we pretty much have it all.
And so how did you get it on NPR? I mean, did they come to you or you pitched it to them or what happened?
We sent it to them. Kim Aubrey, who was one of the greats of radio, he was at WISO and he was at in New York at the Pacifica station and he had gone to Pine Ridge and then he moved to Santa Cruz and he was really instrumental in a lot of people. I mean, dozens of people in Santa Cruz at that time getting our radio licenses. Back then you had to take this FCC test and, you know about plate amps and volts and Mayday and, you know, all the ships at sea kind of thing.
I know. I don't think anybody has them anymore, but I have one.
I was thinking for the Library of Congress that I hope I come across my license and can send that in into our archive there. But so we all learned that. And Kim heard, so we were doing local stuff on KUSP. We had our weekly show. I think Captain McVowdy was like, right before us, and maybe was it the poetry after us, but anyway. So we, Kim said he heard the Road Ranger, our long interview, probably was a half hour, maybe more on our show with the Road Ranger because we went on patrol with him on a July 4th hot weekend as he was helping people who were breaking down on the road. And it really had that feeling of place and time and, you know, almost a cinema verite kind of feel, which is what I think our became what we do.
Trademark.
And Kim said, cut it down and I'll send it to NPR because Kim knew some of the people at NPR, Alex Chadwick, various people, hosts of Weekend All Things Considered, and we sent it off. And then Nikki picked up her phone one day, it was ringing, and it was NPR calling, and she didn't believe it at the time. She thought it was someone, you know, kidding because people knew we wanted, we were aspiring to that. And they went, well, you know, we love this story, but your sound's pretty bad. Yeah. You know, the recording ain't so good. And we wound up, they had these workshops back then where they would bring together aspiring new producers to regional workshops to bring teachers there for us to learn the skills of doing the craft. And we were brought to one of those with, you know, Jay Allison and a bunch of other people were just starting out then and they were there for those things. And that's how we got on NPR, and that's how we got some chops too.
Yeah, that's right. It's a big deal to be a network radio for sure. And do they still air your program?
Yeah, sometimes they do. Since we started podcasting, it's been hard to do those major series in that same way that we've been doing because podcasting is a beast. You know, it will eat you alive. It just has that ongoing thing, but yes. And we have a special that's on public radio right now. I can't imagine Nikki hasn't played it already on K-Squid, but maybe she's about to. It's called Building Speak, Stories of Pioneering Women Architects. And Frances McDormand, the Academy Award-winning actor, is the narrator of this hour-long special. And it rocks.
That's wonderful. So I asked you earlier if being Jewish has influenced your work, but being a woman, has that been more of an influence, would you say, to the things that you do or not?
Yeah, I think it has been. When I first went, my radio life in radio began in high school. I was the noon disc jockey in my high school. And then when I wrote my career notebook in high school on either being a disc jockey or the first woman on the Supreme Court. Music and justice have been these sort of themes running through my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to UC Santa Cruz for college, and the campus radio station was there, KZSC, still is. And yeah. Kim was very much part of that, and Mark Hand, who I mentioned, and there was a news collective at the time, and I got pulled into that station and loved it, and started doing my first radio documentaries there. Well, the first one I ever did was on Woody Guthrie, but then there was a women's radio collective that was starting, and I joined up with that, and so we were playing all women's music at the time on that show. That was the kind of first of it. And then I was also really involved with criminal justice things and was doing research about 19th century women outlaws of the West, and then a sort of a multimedia documentary about them. But it sort of triggered. I never said I'm going to do women's history. That's my beat. But there was it. And it just, even the pioneering women architects, you know, the thing we have most recent, even without trying to, if you're trying to tell stories that have not been told, women's stories, all kinds of immigrant stories, all kind of ethnic groups, all kind of races, it's so many of those stories have been pushed to the side or pushed out the door or never let in the door to begin with. And that's been, you know, we've always gone for the lost stories and the hidden stories. But yes, I mean, probably the favorite story of mine, or one of them that we've done, is called WHER 1000 Beautiful Watts, which is about the first all-girl radio station in the nation, which Sam Phillips, who recorded Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Howlin' Wolf and Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison and Carl Perkins, when he sold Elvis's contract, he used that money to start the first all-girl radio station in the nation. And we chronicled, we did a big, big, fat oral history documentary about those women. And very little had been told about them. And that piece means the world to us. And, you know, we've been tons of women's story. French Manicure, about tales from Vietnamese nail salons, the consequences of war. Are manicuring in this case, you know, consequences of war are many. The Vietnamese War brought all these women to this nation and to the West Coast, and manicuring became a way to get a toehold, find a business. And so we chronicled a lot of those women's lives too. You know, just there's dozens of our stories that are about women. Yeah.
Well, and by telling history stories, they become kind of timeless. Have you stayed away from current political stories over the years?
I mean, we're about to release on our podcast, re-release in kind of a new format, these stories we did during the Hidden Kitchens War and Peace and Food series that we were doing, called Communal Kitchens and Dissident Kitchens, about the role of the kitchen in the Soviet Union. We were in Moscow and interviewing this television journalist and writer, Viktor Arafeyev. And we said to him, what's your hidden kitchen? And he said, dissident kitchens. The Soviet Union fell apart because of the kitchen. And we went, huh, better dig into that one. And so we are, you know, dissident culture in Russia right now is right one of the most burning topics, as we know. And Alexei Navalny, just Russian dissident, just having been killed. And in his honor, we wanted to bring these pieces back and look at how dissidents come to where they find their root, and how people have come together to resist in Russia over the years. And so that's more how we do our, I wouldn't say, I mean, yes, in Santa Cruz, when there was a flood and Nikki and I were first starting on NPR, we covered the flood for NPR, but it wasn't our strength. You know, we weren't those quick turnaround people. And there were two of us. And at that point, how did two people narrate a piece for NPR? They weren't doing that. You know, Radiolab and those things hadn't come. So, and we were two women and we were from the West Coast. There was a lot of resistance to that, but it was more we liked that time to find the archival, to interview a lot of people, to go a little longer, to go down some tangents and tributaries.
I love tangents. They're my favorite.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking this week with public radio pioneer Davia Nelson, one half of the Kitchen Sisters, along with Nikki Silva. And we'll continue our conversation with Davia Nelson right after this short break. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is public radio pioneer Davia Nelson, one half of the Kitchen Sisters, along with Nikki Silva.
Davia, you have this marvelous sound on the radio, you and Nikki both. And was that something that you just that's how you sound, or did you cultivate your particular sound that you have? I don't know what to call it. I don't know how to describe it, but it's a beautiful sound.
Do you mean the sound of our stories or the sound of our voices or both?
Yeah. I mean, you have a sound. There's a sound, the manner in which you both speak. It's a very quiet and intimate way of speaking. And the music that you use is very unique. I'm not talking about the tracks that you play of other people, but you have a sort of a theme song that's very enticing.
Ted Savarese wrote that. It's called Day of the Dead. Yeah.
And was that something that he wrote for you, or you found it somewhere?
No, I had met him. I have a group of friends, and we do an annual Beatles sing. And I had met him at probably the 10th annual Beatles sing. And he sort of said to me, you know, I really love the music in your stories and kind of how you use music. And I make music, and can I send you a CD of mine? And he did. And that cut in particular just really resonated. And we're always kind of sampling, you know, cutting things up, grafting on a different end to a beginning. And kind of, when you say we have a sound, Plato has this quote, he who controls rhythm controls. And I think that's really in our heads. It's probably she who controls rhythm controls. But I think that there's this way in which we're trying to float the stories, not all stories, some we just want clean with no music, but float the stories on a bed of music that has a certain pace, that has a certain rhythm, that has a certain transparency. It can't be too thick. It can't be too busy. I mean, at times it can be, and you break in the story and to let that come up. Lyrics, but not that many, because, you know, you don't want to be too literal when you're trying to tell one of those stories. You know, before the podcast, we had probably been in three of our stories out of hundreds. We were never narrating. It was always a host, or we had a someone like Frances McDormand or Francis Coppola or Paul Auster narrating our specials. But with the podcast came narrating and introducing our stories. You know, we're rarely throughout, but we'll set it up. I think we got so used to it. And also from the start with like Ernie Morgan, the legend of Ernest Morgan, the one-handed pool player, from that, which was maybe our third piece on NPR, our fourth. And it was a one-handed pool player who was a pool shark who went from pool hall to pool hall. He's from the South and a great storyteller. And he would play a game of pool and tell his life story. It was phenomenal. What's the name of this divey bar in Santa Cruz? It said pool shark. We were reading the Sentinel and it said pool shark in town tonight. And it was at this pool hall near Seabright somewhere. And we went, and there he was telling the story. And out of that, when we began to narrate it, we just went, what are we doing in here? We need every second to hear him. We need to hear the clatter of the pool balls. We need to hear racking. We need to hear chalking. We need to hear the jukebox. And he's this older Southern guy. Why are, at that point, we were like 22 years old. What are we doing here? And we just started removing ourselves, editing ourselves out. And we then, I think, started working almost more in that three-act kind of structure without ever saying, let's use the three-act structure. Uh-huh. But they were monologues or multi-voiced, and music helps kind of change the chapter, change the subject, kind of move you through. It's subtle, you know, you don't yeah. know why one thing works and another doesn't. It just, it's our aesthetic. And Nikki loves music as just me, and, you know, is very musical and plays piano and guitar. And, you know, she comes to it deeply.
Can she play the auto harp? That's the question.
I have never seen Nikki Silva play an auto harp, but that doesn't mean she can't. I think she can play accordion.
What is it? That's the sexiest instrument of all time. But yeah. So do you were talking about going in there and cutting tape back in those days. Now we don't have to use tape anymore. But do you have a staff that works for you, or do you do it all yourself?
There are the two of us, and Nikki cuts all when we were reel to reel, when it was analog, cassette to reel, we were both cutting. The day it turned to Pro Tools and went on the computer,
you stopped
I drew I stopped cutting. I have a little child's portion of dyslexia, and I could never track the Pro Tools. But also Nikki has that. Nikki's a phenomenal editor, and she can stay in a chair, and have to get on a plane. You know, we just have the different temperaments. And also she was raising children and I was not. And so more of the time, not so much now, but I was out finding, you know, and doing the interviews. And Nikki, like a composer, you know, she has that gift. I mean, we both go back and forth playing cuts of things for each other and work on that together. But she's the one giving it that big shape. And Nathan Dalton works with us. He's the project manager and producer of the Kitchen Sisters. And Brandy Howell works with us as well. And she's the one who started the series, New Angle Voice, which is about the pioneering women architects that led to us doing that series. So there's four of us. It's not all full time, but people are here and we've been a team. And then Jim McKee, the phenomenal Jim McKee sound designer, does the final mix of 99.9% of all our stories. He has that secret sauce that when you say, why does your stuff sound like it sounds? Because in the end, we'll have everything lined out and know all the tracks and all that. But Jim does that last, that finish that really gives it the sound, I think, that you're speaking of.
Yeah. Well, and it's such a wonderful sound. And now that, you know, I mean, you've chosen to do radio or podcasting rather than the printed word. You do have one book, right? You have a book about the Hidden Kitchens.
Hidden Kitchens, yeah.
which is a great book. But have you thought of writing a book, or that's not your thing?
No, we have been writing a book since the day we stopped the Hidden Kitchens book. We went, oh, there's another book to be written. And so, and then maybe there's also, we did a book about the WHER, a self-published book about WHER, 1,000 Beautiful Watts, and at some point hope to push that to the next level and have that be out in the world. But we're working on a book called Show the Girls the Snakes. And it's sort of the, I don't know what this, what's the colon, you know, the 12 commandments of storytelling or whatever, but it's stories and how we tell stories in our two different lives, you know, two women who've worked together for, you know, decades and live very, very different lives, but come together to do these stories. So this blend.
Yeah, you also are, you guys teach radio as well, right? Or I don't know if we call it radio.
We did. We taught at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, taught radio there. And Nikki has taught up at UC Santa Cruz in the Documentary Studies program. And then we've done 100, maybe more, maybe less, workshops around the world teaching the craft. We love doing that. We call it the Kitchen Sisters interviewing, recording, and podcasting workshop. And mostly it's live, but now with the pandemic, we started going on Zoom and doing it too. We did one, I don't know, 9 months into the pandemic, the first one, maybe even sooner. And it was, I think, 20 different countries. We're on the Zoom together, people in all different time zones, just everyone wanting to learn the craft, everyone wanting to tell stories in the strongest way they could, everyone seeking that community, that fellowship.
That's wonderful. Have you had students who came to you that you now you hear their podcast or they've
Oh
gone?
yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Oh yeah. And when I listen to NPR, I hear them. And when I listen to KQED or KALW, absolutely. Yeah. Well, a lot of our people that we've worked with, either from the workshops or from, we had a really strong internship program for many years, 4 and 5 and 6 interns here in San Francisco with us at a time. And it's really created a beautiful community. And so a lot of them have gone out and on, which is great. Makes me really happy.
Do you have stories that you're waiting to tell and you're just waiting to get to them, or do you discover the stories each time? Well, we need a show, so let's find something.
We have, I don't know, I bet we have, if I looked at a list of story ideas, I bet there are 30 story ideas on it that on with different levels of got to tell that story, hope to tell that story. Gee, hope I don't die before I tell it. You know what I mean? There's without having those labels by it, there are all that. But then, so there's those ones we're trying to always go. Right now, we're working on a story called Cool Hair, Great Smile, Remembering Knox Phillips, about the son of Sam Phillips and Becky Phillips, record producer and keeper of that Phillips family legacy, who died right at the beginning of the pandemic. And so that was 2020, and here it is 2024, and we're doing that story now that we meant to do all those years ago, but there were so many other stories, and stories ripen. You don't know how long you have to sit on those eggs, or why that's, you can't get yourself to go to that one. You've gone to another, things pull you, or the news pulls you, or someone's anniversary or world events. It's a mysterious process. But yeah, there's a ton. And then there's things I don't even know that, I could walk out this door and a
Oh.
story can pop out of you at the bushes. We have one of the commandments we have in the 12 commandments of stories telling is always pack your piece, always have your recording equipment, because you never know when a story will jump out of the bushes at you and you
Oh.
want to be prepared.
So you used to probably have a great big unit of, sort of a reel to reel with microphones, but now I guess you could have it in your pocket if you wanted.
Yeah, it is. It's a little handheld Zoom. It makes me sad. I appreciate it because it's hard when it's big and heavy. It's easy to not take it, right? You just go, oh God, I'm going to be out all night, and then we're going to be at the parade, and then we're going to go here, and then we're going to go there. And so I'm just going to leave it at home. And then you didn't record it. So on the other hand, the tiny Zoom is so agile that you bring it. So it's not on that great quality, that highest quality level, but you are there with equipment and you are more likely to record.
Well,
So.
it's interesting that your career, even though we're only 28, that your career has spanned this acceleration of technology. I mean, when we started in radio, if you wanted to hear something, you had to listen to the radio. And now anybody can hear anything they want, anytime they want. And lost and found, the things that you used to come up with, oh, listen, we found this recording and it's so rare. But now, like, nothing is rare and everything is on YouTube. Does it diminish its value when it's so available?
Well, I won't say it diminishes its value, but I will say that for me, one of the things I loved about radio when I was possessed by it, so young, in high school, well, even before, I just hung on transistor radios from the time I was probably 10, the music and the rhyming DJs and all that. But was the ephemerality of it. I loved that it was there in that moment and then it was gone. And how mysterious. I have a theory. I'm very nearsighted. I don't have great eyes. And if you go to a radio or a podcast convention, 80% of the people are wearing glasses and the other 20%, I bet, are wearing contacts. But I think maybe there's something about people that don't see as well who are seeing, hearing really well, listening harder. I mean, that only applies so much because when I met Nikki's one of those people with supervision and who can see, she acquires so much visual knowledge of a situation so fast. And she loves radio too. So my theory has holes. But anyway, I do love the, I did love that piece of it. That, like, I read a Marcello Mastroianni quote about how I am, he was talking about the theater, and he said, I am a devoted to an art form that evaporates. I loved that. I love that way of thinking about it. In order for it to exist, you have to do it again. You have to begin again and let it exist again, and then it's gone, and then you come back the next night to the theater and you do it again. And there was something about that that resonated for me. Or like cooking, you made this, went out, you worked hard to make a beautiful meal, get great ingredients, everyone gathered around the table, and then it was over.
They ate
And you have
it.
the memory of it, you ate it.
Yeah.
And then you began again. All these, something about that process is what lured me to it. Ira Glass says radio has the best pictures, or radio is the most visual medium there is, and I really believe that if you do it right.
You were just telling me all these stories you want to tell. You don't have any plans to retire. You are going forward forever.
Forever. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine why I would. There's just so much that needs telling, that begs to be told, that is so beautiful. People whose mission, we really care about people possessed by a sound, but people possessed by a vision for community. People, some people run for elected office, other people elect themselves to be the keepers of some piece of their community, and those people are essential, so we want to shine a light on that. To
Well,
get to craft.
tell me about the Library of Congress. Was that one where they came to you and they said, "We want your," I once, I can't imagine the Library of Congress. What is that like? I mean, do they send an overdue notice when you're?
You haven't sent in your sound. We were doing a story called "The Passion of Chris Strachwitz" about the amazing record producer, and record store owner and filmmaker Chris Strachwitz. And he had gotten older, and his collection had gone into the Smithsonian. And the Smithsonian is keeping the Arhuli record collection alive, and people can continue to order Arhuli records through the Smithsonian. So we were making this piece, and we worked with the Smithsonian, and they were giving us all of Chris's music that we wanted for the piece, and it was incredible. And therefore, we could really expand all the music that we wanted to. It was really like a musical when we were moving you through Chris's childhood in Germany to today, and all this different music, the German, the Latino, the Norteña, the Tejano, the Zydeco, all of it that Chris was obsessed with, and all these cultures that he honored. Okay, so at the end of it, the guy who was the head of Smithsonian Folkways at the time, we'd worked together for a month or two by this point, and he said to me, "So what's going to happen to the Kitchen Sisters archive?" And I was sort of taken aback, and he said, and I said, "Well, what do you think should happen to the Kitchen Sisters archive?" And he said, "Well, there's obviously only one place for it." And because he was at the Smithsonian, I'm kind of thinking, huh, is he thinking we belong in the Smithsonian? And he said, the Library of Congress, of course, where else would it be? That's got to go into the Library of Congress. And I have to say, Nikki and I, when we first got together, so beyond, we started making pilgrimages to Washington, D.C. often because NPR was there and because the Library of Congress was there and National Archives. And back then, you could just bring your tape recorder and an RCA plug and go from their reel-to-reel tape recordings of so much of radio and national history and all manner of recording and put it onto cassettes. And we would build stories from those cassettes for years. Those recordings have been part of it. And it's what got us started on our sound of archival audio being such a fundamental part of our sound and way of telling history. Anyway, so I have to say that that place has had such a point of reverence for me, and knowing Alan Lomax and Zora Neale Hurston and, Studs Terkel and Pete Seeger and all these people are in it, let alone the, comes to, the documents. So when he said that, he said, well, listen, I know the head of this division of the Library of Congress. If you write a letter describing your collection and what's in it and what its big themes are, I will give it to her and just pass it along. And he did. And it took several years for them to decide, yes, we do want to acquire this. But they did. And it was a saga. And, we have such reverence for those archivists, for those librarians, for the keepers of the nation's sonic heritage and written heritage and all that, especially when all librarians and archivists are under such attack at this moment in time and so much is being banned. These people are heroes. These are national treasure. And so to be cho to have our work chosen to be saved, to be kept in perpetuity and be go into the public domain. Yeah, it's
That's fantastic.
hard
Well,
to describe
congratulations.
what
Yeah,
that
I must be
means.
very proud. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's fantastic.
7,000 hours, Gary.
Wow.
7,000 hours of
Oh
sound. Wade in the water.
my God. So, even you don't have time to listen to it before you give it to them.
We're trying to listen to a ton of it and trying to digitize a ton of it so we have a copy of it. So they'll have the masters and all, but some of it's going to be there
Yeah,
one day. We'll be getting a library card to check out a kitchen system.
instead.
GAT.
Yeah. Well, Davia Nelson, it's just so wonderful to talk to you. I'm honored that you made some time for From the Bookshelf, and congratulations on the Library of Congress and on doing all the things that you keep doing. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Gary, and for your support across the years. You have been such a booster of the Kitchen Sisters and always sent us such positive notes and funny and dear, and you do such amazing work there. And I'm so glad we're in the Sonic family together.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.